We are talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and we're talking today to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the new book Opera Unveiled, now in its 15th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
And we're talking today about The Marriage of Figaro by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And there's a Mozart opera almost every year, not quite, but almost every year at the Santa Fe Opera. Mm. Why are Mozart operas so popular and just so great by so many people's opinion?
Yeah, how has it lasted 200 years?
Yeah.
You know, what is it when there are so many operas written all the time? And in those days, the composers wrote many, many operas, you know, two or three operas a year. What is it about Mozart? Of course, that's the million-dollar question that physicists and philosophers and mathematicians, along with artists, have tried to figure out. Well, to answer the first part of your question, the Santa Fe Opera had always originally done a Mozart opera every year. It's something that John Crosby believed in, that we would always have a Mozart opera. And personally, it's music you never tire of. There's a structure and an order in this music that maybe we need in our lives. It provides a balance. It doesn't have the histrionics of later operas. It maybe doesn't have quite the same passion. But Mozart deals with human nature and with people in ways that are so compassionate that you don't need to understand the opera to get a sense of this. He's never critical of his characters, no matter how bad they are. Even Don Giovanni, whom I know you hate.
I do not like him.
He's never judged. I mean, they drag him off to hell, and that's his just deserts. But Mozart's not critical, and he's not critical of women, which in those days was phenomenal, because women were definitely second-class citizens in the late 1700s.
I had a writing teacher once who said, "You must, if you're going to write good fiction, you must never judge your characters. You can't have a moral attitude toward your characters."
No, that's from the outside. But even as you're writing about the characters from the inside, you have to be very careful of how that bias and slant is.
Yeah.
I mean, everything we read in the papers today is a clear bias as to where the journalist, the writer, reporter, or the paper, I mean, as a whole, is coming from. It's very hard to find unbiased journalism. And I think Mozart fits that criteria. Apart from the fact that he has this God-given gift for music, the man himself was an odd little funny character who was a bit of a wild man. You know, he bucked the system. He was supposed to do as his father taught him. Father taught him how to play music, and he was a child phenomenon. But he couldn't maintain that as he grew up. He was no longer a child, and he was supposed to just be quiet and play in the orchestra of the Archbishop of Salzburg, and he wouldn't do it. He didn't like being sat at the bottom of the servant's table, which is what happened in the Archbishop's court when he used to, as a child, sit on the lap of Marie Antoinette and asked her if she'd marry him. You know, he was used to all of this, and he didn't think it was appropriate that the musician should be placed at the end of the table. So he'd take longer and longer leaves from court, and at one point he was actually physically kicked out by the pants out of the court, and because he wouldn't toe the line. You know, he was an appendage to the Archbishop for the greater glorification of a prince of the church, and he didn't see art in that role. So he went to Vienna, and he did what no other musician had done before. He struck out on his own. In those days, you had to have a patron, someone who was paying the bills or commissioning your work, and he could have really gone under, but thanks to a number of situations. First of all, when the emperor heard his music, he realized there was something wonderful going on here. Emperor Joseph was in touch with music. He was a musician himself. He understood music. And then there was the incredible Lorenzo da Ponte, who had been a priest at one point, but had so many affairs he was kicked out of the church. So he arrives in Vienna.
A few would have been okay.
Yeah, yes, but this was not appropriate. So he arrives in Vienna, and he becomes the librettist for many of the composers at the time. And when he heard about this particular story, he and Mozart wanted to do an opera on the Marriage of Figaro, which had been banned by the emperor for good reason, because the base is a play by Caron de Beaumarchais, which was written in Paris in 1775. Beaumarchais was a colorful character, a Frenchman not of the aristocracy. He wrote The Barber of Seville and The Marriage of Figaro, two great hits. He did everything. He even sold guns to the Americans for New Orleans at one point. I mean, he was quite a gregarious character. So he was a Figaro. You know, he's fighting the system. His operas and his Figaro, which is really himself, I think, are bucking the system. Why should servants be treated like this when their masters may be stupid? And he sort of goes out of his way to point that up. That certainly happens in this opera. But as such, of course, this was a real challenge to the ruling classes and to the royalty, the aristocracy. This, remember, is still just before the French Revolution. But the stirrings are there, and the French king would not allow the play to be performed, and then it was banned across Europe, and the emperor said, no, Da Ponte, you cannot do this opera. So Da Ponte must have had a great way with him. He said to the emperor, he said, I'll take out all the political bits and anything that might offend your majesty. And anyway, you should hear the music of Mozart. So Mozart goes in, plays with the emperor, and the emperor says, yes, it sounds marvelous. The opera can go ahead. So on one hand, you know, there is this little political dilemma going on one side, but the music that Mozart writes is quite extraordinary. You can listen to it in many different situations, scenarios. I mean, listen to it at home, listen to it in your car, go to the opera, hear recordings. It's... There's a beauty that you don't have to be a musicologist to understand. It's simple melody with beautiful embroidering, and it is timeless. I mean, it's really stood the test of time. I must say, in my work, where I'm never quite sure which composers I'm going to be working with when, sometimes I'm working with Wagner, working on a Wagner opera, there's all that visceral passion that really churns you up, and I long to go back to a Mozart opera where there's order and structure. And then after a while with Mozart, I'm ready to get back to Wagner or Verdi or Puccini, whoever it happens to be. So I think these are the great geniuses. And this is a word that has to apply to people of this caliber. It's a God-given gift. They are geniuses. And I think standing the test of this long time points that up. So you can place this opera in many different scenarios, even though it seems locked into the 1700s. Our production this year is a pretty much a traditional one. However, having said that, the Santa Fe Opera does not tend to do these totally bizarre, you know, off-the-chart productions that one sees in Europe. You still recognize the opera. And I think the production we will have with Bruce Donnell directing will be lovely. So we should probably talk about some of these characters, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, besides the music being timeless, the stories are really great, too.
Yes, they are. And always given this extraordinary issue of Mozart taking up the cause for women, which we'll talk about. But first of all, we meet the Count Almaviva. This entire cast is actually carried over from The Barber of Seville, which was the first of the three plays that Beaumarchais wrote. The Count Almaviva in that opera had gone to Sevilla to pursue Rosina. And Figaro was the factotum who had manipulated everything there and made it possible for the Count to abduct, marry, and run off with Rosina. And now Rosina is the Countess. She's made the leap from being a chaperoned young teenager to being the wife of Count Almaviva, who, once the first passion of marriage and love has worn off, is now philandering away and has his eye on all sorts of other women, which she is not happy about, especially when it's so close to home. And he really desires Susanna, who is the Countess's maid. Susanna is engaged to be married to Figaro. So the very opening of the opera could not be more commonplace. It's the young couple, they're fiancés, and they're in a room they've been given, a bedroom, and he's measuring the floor for the double bed, and she's trying on wedding hats. And she says to him, she says, you know, Figaro, why we've been given this room, so that the Count, who can nip in at any time he feels like it, and Figaro's appalled. He said, no, that's not right. So let's hear first from the Count, from Count Almaviva. He, halfway through the opera, realizes that he is being manipulated right, left, and center, and he's very angry about it. So he sings, must I see a serf of mine made happy while I am left to sigh, and him possess a treasure which I desire in vain? Must I see her who has roused in me a passion united by the hand of love to a base slave? That's his aria. Allora lasciarti in pace, non That's another thing about a Mozart aria. You always know when the end comes and when it's time to applause is a great chord. So that's Count Almaviva. Now, his wife, remember, was the bubbly Rosina in the Barber of Seville. She's now a saddened woman. She's literally sort of on a pedestal in her ivory tower. Because she's the countess, she can't play around like she did in the earlier opera. She's limited. She has, for her to be friends with Susanna, her maid, is even difficult. But those two, it's another great example of Mozart's understanding of women. The two of them are very good friends. They're sort of like sisters. And they both get in the plot against the count. And in this aria, the countess sings of her loneliness and her sadness. She still loves the count, but she knows what's going on, and she's really unhappy about it. And we don't even see her until the beginning of the second act in this opera. And we hear of her sadness in two beautiful arias, and this is one where she is mourning the fact that her husband has left her, and she's wondering how she can get him back. I should say before we get into this cut that this is one of the most beautiful recordings of all time for this opera. It's from the Metropolitan Opera with James Levine conducting. The count who we just heard is Thomas Hampson. The countess is Kiri Tikhanova. This was one of her great roles. The Susanna is Dawn Upshaw, who has been here in Santa Fe a number of times. And Figaro is Ferruccio Furlanetto, who is still out there doing an incredible job. A bass baritone, actually, his voice is. And the Cherubino we'll hear from later is Sophie Vonata. But now let's hear from Kiri Tikhanova singing Dove Sono. Thank you. Only a tiny touch of that, I'm afraid. Yeah. Dove Sono from The Countess, from The Marriage of Figaro. You have to go to the opera house to hear the whole thing. And now we should hear from Figaro himself. We have a special Figaro in this production. This is a young man who last year was an apprentice, actually, and he sang a small role of Angelotti in Tosca. So I thought it might be fun to hear from him in his own words.
So he's made it big for From
He's
apprentice
made it big
to
overnight.
Figaro.
Yeah, and some good stuff in the middle. So let's hear from Zachary Nelson.
3 years ago, I was a young artist at Glimmer Glass Opera, and I had the opportunity to cover Figaro. So I learned it and got to work with a great director, David Angus. And then last year, I was an apprentice at Santa Fe Opera, and I sang Angelotti and covered Manchuca and Arabella, and they wanted to hear me for Figaro. And so I gave an audition for Charles and Brad, and next thing I know, I got the call that I was going to be singing Figaro at Santa Fe Opera. It's a thrill just to even get that news. This will be my first Figaro, and I couldn't be more thrilled about it. I've been looking forward to this opportunity ever since I started singing. It was the first aria I ever learned was Non Pion Durai. Figaro tries to be quick on his feet the entire time. Sometimes, like in the Act Two finale, he wasn't expecting Antonio to drunkenly come in and scream about some boy jumping out of a window. That never occurred to Figaro. So he has to think on his feet, and he takes the blame for it. He says, no, that was me. You're drunk. You have no idea what's going on. And he tries to be very cool about things. We all know maybe someone like Figaro in our lives. Whether you like that person or not, that's your own preference. I think Figaro is very charming. And when he is the moments where you can see his wit and you can see how clever he is, he can sometimes be like a little eel. Like you try to grab him and he just slips right out of your hands. It's very entertaining. And I think he's great. I think he's just the bee's knees. There are many surprises, many, many surprises. And you can thank Beaumarchais and DePonte for that. When I left Santa Fe, I felt like I was singing the best I had ever sung in my life. And I think it has to do with just working every day, but also the actual place of Santa Fe. You're up high in the mountains. It's like extreme training. I called it extreme singing while I was out there. You're up in high altitude. It's very dry. And I got used to that. And I came back down to sea level at the end of the summer. And I could open any score and just sing it. And I never really had that kind of experience before. And so I'm looking forward to going back out there and doing some more extreme singing training.
I love that extreme singing training.
Yes, exactly.
Usually
the singers complain bitterly about having to sing at 7,000 feet. It really is demanding. But of course, the upside is that when they go back to sea level, they can sing effortlessly, which is why marathon runners train at this altitude.
Yeah, and bicyclists.
Yes, exactly. It's great when you get back to sea level, but it's lovely that he puts that nice spin on it. So there, Zachary Nelson will be singing our Figaro. But the aria I'd like to play you a little of right now is Si Vuol Ballare sung by Ferruccio Furlanetto. It's a Figaro, his first aria, when he realizes that the Count, his master, has his eye on his fiancée. He sings, "If, my dear Count, you feel like dancing, it's I who'll call the tune," which, of course, was a revolutionary thing to say in the late 1700s. Let's hear a little of that.
Sì. insegnerò, sì, le insegnerò.
So that's Si Vuol Ballare by Figaro from The Marriage of Figaro.
And we're talking to Desiree Mays. It's our annual opera series. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. We're back with Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, the book that's about the Santa Fe Opera every year, now in its 15th year. And we're talking about The Marriage of Figaro, and one of the characters in it is what I like to call the dreaded pants roles. But there's a, basically women singing the parts of young men, which I guess is, as we've talked about many times in the past, is traditional. There is a wonderful character called Cherubino, mm-hmm. who is in love with love itself.
Yes, absolutely. Kierkegaard actually wrote about this. He wrote about the evolution of love in the characters of Mozart, starting with Cherubino. And in this aria, Non si più, he sings about how he is in love with love. He's in love with every woman in the opera. It's an interesting sort of job he has. Cherubino is from a good family, and often in those days, to learn manners, a young man would be sent to an aristocratic family to learn manners. But I think he's getting an education his parents never dreamed of. He's falling in love with women right, left, and center, really getting underneath the Count's feet, who's very angry about it. And they all treat him very lightly. But in this aria, which is sung by a mezzo-soprano, Sophie Von Otto, on this recording, it's a lovely moment. It's that time before you've fallen in love, before there's an object of the love that you fear that exists. It's a very human moment. I mean, Mozart deals with human moments. And when he does sing to the Countess of how he's in love with her, it's painful. You know, first love is painful. Are you doing the right thing, saying the right thing, wearing the right thing? All of those issues come up.
It's essential adolescent or teenage emotion.
Rite of passage that I suppose we all at one time, one way or another, have to go through. So he sings, I no longer know what I'm doing or thinking. I'm burning. Now I'm made of ice. Every woman makes me change color, blush. every woman makes me tremble. At the very word love or beloved, my heart leaps and pounds, and to speak of it fills me with a longing I can't explain. I speak of love when I'm awake. I speak of it in my dreams. To the stream, the shade, the mountains, the flowers, the grass, the fountains. To the echo, the air, and the breezes, which carry away with them the sound of my fond words. And I've none to hear me other than myself.
Read in a trembling voice by Desiree Mays.
Absolutely. In my pants.
You're in your pants roll.
My pants roll. This is a Cherubino.
Thank you.
We're listening to music from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart.
And that is the sound of being in love with love.
That's right.
It's as simple as that. And it's irresistible. And you don't have to understand what the words are about. You really do not.
But it helps.
It helps. It does. It's another dimension. In opera, you can just listen to the music and know this is upbeat and fun. There's a lot of comedy in this opera. This is not a tragic opera by any stretch of the imagination.
And as always, I mean, we've talked about this also so many times, is that opera singers now have to really be actors. And if they're playing in a comedic opera, they have to have comic timing, and
they do. There's all of that.
Yeah, the sense on stage.
Though, unlike The Duchess of Gerolstein, which has spoken dialogue between the musical numbers, this is sung throughout. So the entire piece will be sung in Italian. This was the language of the court at the time. German was Mozart's first language, and he really wanted to write in German, but it was politically incorrect. So these great operas, the Don Giovanni Così Van Tutte and The Marriage of Nozze di Figaro, are all in Italian. But later in his career, he did manage to write one opera in his native language, German, which is the De Zauberflöte, the magic flute.
That's right.
And this wasn't even written for the court. It was written for a people's theater. So, and it appealed to the people. I mean, this was a time where typically only the aristocracy went to opera. They held the operas in their private homes, in their palaces. There weren't theaters per se. They were just beginning to have theaters. So the magic flute played in one of these early theaters with a great cross-section of people, which was very successful, and in German that they could understand.
I think if there's one theme that runs throughout these operas, is that the demise of the aristocracy is probably a really good thing.
And I don't know about that so much, but I think it's making opera available to everyone.
No, I don't mean that. I mean in the stories.
Oh, in the stories,
the
yes.
aristocracy yeah. are always making life miserable.
Miserable for underlings.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And in this opera, Mozart takes a stand for servants. There needs to be equality. He takes a stand for women. They should not be treated like second-class citizens. And with Cherubino, he takes a stand for the young. You know, they have a voice. The Count gets rid of Cherubino by
assigning
him.
They have a voice, soprano.
Yeah, mezzo, depending. Yeah,
that's right.
Well, he gets shipped off to the army because he's in the way and he doesn't have any say about it. So there is a sort of a political agenda under the surface of this opera. But the people who went to see this opera, you know, they got great enjoyment out of it. They could laugh at themselves, which was probably, you know, the irony of history. A few years later, they were in the depths of the French Revolution, and the end of that whole era came to a crashing down, rather like again the Duchess of Gerolstein, where everybody laughed with Offenbach at the carryings on of the army when a few years later they were at war and the opera was not relevant anymore. But this opera has really survived the test of time. There's a lot of comedy in it, and that's then up to the director to really pull that out. Directors play now probably a major leading role in opera. When I was a child reared on opera in Ireland, the conductor was the main event. And before that, it was the singer. You know, you went to hear a singer, and the singer seemed to call the shots, right down to deciding how they would sing their arias and which version they'd sing. Then the conductor, and now the director. But where there's great theater and there needs to be dynamic pacing and drama and continuity, directors can make or break these productions.
You were reared on opera?
Yes, from the age of 7. I mean, I was taken to the opera as a child. I was so fortunate. My parents took me and my sisters, my two younger sisters, to the opera, ballet, and symphony twice a year. I mean, we were that young going to these operas. I mean, I remember falling in love with Pinkerton in Butterfly when I was age 8. And then one time Vanessa and my sister, the two of us, were sitting on the bus, the number 8 bus, going from Dublin back to where we lived, right by the James Joyce Tower, actually, where our house was, and we're discussing in great depth. I was about 9 and she was 7. I mean, we were discussing in depth the concert we'd heard the night before, and there was an Irish Times reporter sitting behind us and wrote it up and put it in the paper.
Oh, my goodness.
It was so amazing. And my sister then shortly afterwards fell in love with the violin, and became a violinist in the Irish Symphony Orchestra, playing in the very orchestra we had been taken to as children.
And you became a dancer.
And I became a dancer, yes.
And
yes.
You danced in opera productions.
In opera productions. But to be a dancer, well, I was in a convent where the nuns did not appreciate my leaping about and swinging my legs at the desks. I mean, they were not happy about my dance instincts. So my family sent me to England at the age of 13. I mean, I think of it now, it's amazing. I went alone on the mail boat and a train to get to a school in England where I studied dance along with theatre arts and school subjects until I became a student in London, and then was very fortunate to be able to dance in the opera ballet and with a ballet company and made movies, and you did everything you could to survive because there was no full-time job in the arts. That's where where I first learned about opera. First of all, by being taken as a child. You know, we'd all get dressed up and go, and it was a marvelous experience. So back to the comedy here. In the beginning is straight slapstick comedy, where everybody descends on Susanna's room. Cherubino is there, and when the Count nearly discovers him, hides under a piece of furniture, a curtain or an armchair or something, and then the Count shouldn't be there when Figaro comes in, so he hides in the same place. I mean, straight slapstick comedy. In the second act, they are in the Countess's room, and Cherubino has just sung her a love song. And they're in the process of dressing Cherubino up as a girl. I won't get into all the plot details. So he's in a state of semi-undress when the Count shows up knocking at the door of his wife's bedroom. And that
and
leads to farce.
A boy being played by a girl dressed up as a girl.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's an amazing piece. There's a number of marriages in this that are looked at. Marriage is the purpose of this piece. There's the Count and the Countess, whose marriage is a little rocky but gets resolved. There is Susanna and Figaro, who are trying to get married and actually do love each other. And Susanna may well be the central character in this opera. She is true to herself and everyone else, and she tries to make it all work out. And Figaro, who with the best intentions keeps putting his foot in it, actually, in this opera. Things don't work out. I mean, he's not a problem solver. And then there's an older couple. There's Dr. Bartolo and Marcellina. In the second act, fairly early on, Marcellina, who knows now that Figaro wants to marry Susanna, produces a piece of paper that says he can't marry Susanna, he has to marry me. Because, it turns out, he had borrowed a sizable sum of money from Marcellina years ago, this is Figaro, and if he didn't pay it back, he had to marry her. And he hasn't paid it back. So the Count is delighted because this puts him now in the situation of bribing the couple. He says to Susanna, if you will be mine, I will give you a dowry with which you can pay off Marcellina and you can get married. But Susanna doesn't fall for this either. And that whole thing gets resolved in this really funny scene where...
And meanwhile, this is Marcellina's not the ideal bride.
No, she's Marcellina's an old woman. You know, she and have come all the way from the Barber of Seville. They've been around a while. Bartolo was the man who hoped to marry Rosina, who's now the Countess. So you have to remember this whole little bit of back history.
It's like a soap opera.
It's like a soap opera. This is Barber of Seville Part 2. But what happens then is just as Marcellina is about to insist and the Count is calling a court with a stuttering lawyer, Figaro says, I can't get married without my parents' permission because I'm of the aristocracy. And everything stops still. And he shows a tattoo or some mark that he has on his arm, which Marcellina recognizes. And he says, oh, Raffaello, she says, it's her son. So it's that stupid, silly farce thing that Figaro is Marcellina's son, so they can't be married. So it turns out if she's the mother, who's the father? And lo and behold, it's Dr. Bartolo, who all these years has held out against marrying Marcellina, but now he's going to make an honest woman of her. So they have these three couples who, in the course of this opera, are going to work it all out and do, of course.
And everybody ends up happy, presumably more or less happy or very happy with the right person.
Yes, they do. The last scene is, again, a farce. It's in the gardens of the palace where all these different couples are meeting in shady arbors and making love. And the Count thinks he's making love to Susanna because she's changed clothes. She and the Countess have changed clothes. And he finds out, to his horror, he's been making love to his own wife. So he comes out looking pretty shamefaced, and everybody assembles. And in the most gorgeous music, I'm going to play a little of this, the Countess forgives him. He kneels by her feet, and he asks forgiveness. So the opera becomes about forgiveness, about compassion. We all have our human failings, and it can all be forgiven in the end. Let's hear just a little of that, the final perdono, forgive me. He asks of her, and she forgives. So that's the final forgiveness at the end of the Marriage of Figaro. Now, there are a number of – there's so much music. I mean, I would love to play the entire piece. But
well, why don't we just play the whole opera?
Yeah, well, no, you have to go up to the opera house.
You have to go to
our wonderful opera house on the hill. That's part of the experience here. I mean, it is so thrilling. I talk to artists, directors, and people all over the country where I go lecturing. And they have – and we heard a little in the course of these interviews from some of the singers and how in love they are with coming here. First of all, there's a standard of professionalism at the Santa Fe Opera that's quite staggering. I think it could not be matched anywhere else in this country. There's a courtesy with which the artists are treated, and it's all about the opera. That everything is laid on for them. They're well taken care of, and it really pays. I mean, with the young singers, they get a chance to study with the great directors and designers. You know, they're learning or as they go along, and they're learning from the leading singers, who are very generous with them.
There's also, for the audience, there's really something for everybody.
Yeah.
If you're in love with opera singing itself, mm-hmm. you're in for a treat. If you're not, but you love theater, most of it is fantastic theater. Mm-hmm. If you want sort of the experience of being in that open-air theater
right.
with the wind blowing through and the sun setting and all senses are basically being mm-hmm. stimulated.
Yes,
it's a wonderful thing.
Wagner called it Gesamtkunstwerke,
yeah.
A total artwork, because it's not just about the singing. There are so many components in an opera that have to come together. The singing, the direction, the music, first and foremost, the orchestra, the conductors, the sets, the costumes, the makeup, wigs. Even the climate at the Santa Fe Opera plays a role in what goes on. And you know, Mary, Charlotte, on the nights where everything comes together, I don't care who is in the audience, how much or little they've seen opera, everybody gets it.
Yeah.
It's the magic happens. For you, I know it happened in part of La Traviata. And
The whole of La Traviata, from beginning to end.
That's right. And you've only got to have that hit once, and you'll go back for more. And the more and more you go, hopefully the more you get it. I mean, there are times I go to performances hoping that the magic's all going to happen, and things happen where there is no magic. It's a good performance, but it just doesn't do the total transcendent experience.
And even for the performers and the conductors, there's no way to control that. Some things just happen.
Exactly, and it's when it all comes together, all of those components. And I think at our house, it's a very special experience.
For those who have never been to the opera before, be sure to really dress for the weather.
Yes.
I've been up there dressed in fleece and scarves and things like that, and then other times it's really hot. So.
Yep.
Really be sure to
yeah,
because you can be
layers.
Up there and be cold.
Yes, you can. Well, we're all praying this year that you will be cold because we need the monsoons.
Yeah, we could use some rain during the opera.
If there's a lot of rain, then – but you can never tell. I mean, I can leave El Dorado in 80-degree temperatures, get half an hour away to the opera and need winter clothes. You know, it's staggering. And the show always goes on. I mean, I have lectured up there with thunder and lightning and sheets of water falling off the cantina roof, and it's scary, but the show goes on. It really does.
And the other thing is, be sure, I mean, if you go and go early and have your little tailgate picnic, that's fine, but even if you don't, even if you get up there 10 minutes before curtain, be sure to have eaten, because if you're at the opera hungry, which I have done, it's a nightmare.
No, don't do that, because there were little small things sold. But no, you should really get there early. That's why I think going up and having dinner at the theater is great, because first of all, you get your car parked and somewhere you can get out easily. You're in the right frame of mind. There's something about coming down from the day. No matter if it's been a good, bad, or an indifferent day, you need to leave the day in the car park. You really do. So that takes a little buffer of time. Rushing in into your seat. I mean, that's, I suppose, originally what an overture is for, to give people time to make the transition. But to make this a real experience, tailgate, that's such fun. I mean, get your friends, get together. It doesn't matter if it's a five-course meal with matching wines or a hamburger and a beer. It's fine. Or come to the cantina where I hang out each night. That's a lovely spot to come to dinner.
Now, tell us about your pre-opera lectures.
Yeah, this is the preview buffet in what is now called the Florence Dapples Pavilion, thanks to this wonderful woman who donated a lot of money to completely revamp what was the cantina and what is actually still the cantina during the day, where the artists all meet and eat. In the evening, they make it look absolutely lovely, and now there's a designer tent over the cantina, so you're not going to get wet. There's a lovely meal served. It's a meal that suits everyone. If you're vegetarian, you can eat vegetarian. There's red and white wine included with your meal. And I come up with dessert. I do a sort of a 25-minute introduction to the opera. And typically at the opera, whereas my book deals with the operas themselves, since I don't know so much about production at that point, I just talk about the opera. When I'm up there, I talk about the director's point of view. For instance, the year before, when Peter Sellers was here, I'm about to start my talk and talk about his opera. He was the director in a somewhat controversial production, and I sense this being at my right shoulder. And if you've ever seen a picture of Peter Sellers, he's very small, and his hair is short but stands straight up on his head, and he's just a powerhouse of energy, and I sense this being, and he's got this sort of puppy dog look, may I? And when I saw him, I said, oh, ladies and gentlemen, here's the one and only Peter Sellers. And I put him on, and he carried on, ad-libbed for, 15 minutes about his opera. And they were so ecstatic. I mean, up to 200 people come to this dinner every night. But it's beautifully organized. You know, everybody's seated and comfortable. So they heard Peter Sellers. And this year, each year I try and hope that some director is going to help me out. And then I fill in the bits that they didn't cover. So, yes, I'm up there every night. And to get tickets for the preview buffet, they need to be booked when you book your opera tickets, if not beforehand, because they are selling out. They sell out. So, call the box office about that.
Now, The Marriage of Figaro was performed in 2008 here at the Santa Fe Opera, and at the time that you and I are recording this, we haven't seen the production yet. Is it a similar production? Are we using more or less the same
sets? No, it's the same
sets?
Production. It's the same production, but with a new director.
But the scenery on that was gorgeous.
It was lovely, and it's traditional. Bruce Donnell, who has an incredible career, he's directed many times at the Met and directed many times here. He is going to be the director for this opera. And I should tell you, I mean, I'm sure many of our listeners here saw The Last Savage, which was an incredible, wonderful piece, with Daniel O'Coolidge singing The Last Savage. This is the singer who is singing The Count in this production.
Ah,
so there's,
nice.
There's a shift for him. Susanna Phillips is singing The Countess, and she has a major career now. And we heard from Zachary Nelson, who last year was an apprentice singing a small role.
And this year is Figaro.
He's singing Figaro. And we have a new singer with a wonderful career behind her, Lisette Oroposa, singing Susanna. John Nelson, who's been here many times, will conduct. So it promises to be a really nice production. So we should hear another piece of music.
Okay. Yeah, we've got time.
Let's go to De Vieni. This is the aria of Susanna. It's the very end of the opera where everything's been resolved, and she takes center stage and she sings about love and forgiveness. It's a very beautiful piece. Listen for the strings, flutes, oboe, and bassoon. as we hear Susanna. And the Susanna on this recording is Dawn Upshaw.
Listening to the music of The Marriage of Figaro, it's just about time to go. Desiree Mays, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe talking about this Mozart opera.
It's always fun. Thanks so much for inviting me, Mary Charlotte.
And by the way, we want to talk a little bit about some other things that are going on. There are some more talks, and we talked about tailgate picnics and stuff. You can actually buy the dinners.
Yes, you can. You can call and arrange, I think 48 hours ahead of time, they will prepare dinner for you if you don't have time to do it yourself. And that's fine. They're tasty dinners. You bring a bottle of wine, a couple of glasses. So you can call the box office and order that ahead of time and pick it up when you get there, which is nice. And the other thing people should know about, and most people do, of course, are the prelude talks. The opera presents at 2 hours before the curtain and 1 hour before the curtain. There's a talk in Stirn Hall, and that's if you have a ticket to the show. Those talks are free. They're presented, I think, most of them by Oliver Present, and they're fun to go to, too. It's another way of getting an introduction to the opera. So if you have tickets, you've had your tailgate dinner, plan it so you can do that as well. So if it's an 8:30 curtain, his talk is 6:30 and 7:30. So there's plenty of wonderful things to do at the opera. The box office is an enormous help, and they welcome calls if you have any questions about any of this stuff. For people who really don't want to drive all the way from Albuquerque, it's a very reasonable, there's one or two pickup points, book well in advance, and then you don't have to worry about trying to go home when you have Mozart filling your soul and you don't feel like driving.
And, I mean, just to kind of reiterate what we've been saying about the experience of the opera, it really is an opportunity to, instead of having your life compartmentalized into little half-hour chunks and be running from one thing to another, I mean, you can start at 5 mm-hmm. o'clock and the whole entire rest of your day is made up of talks and dinner and mm-hmm. hanging out and watching the sunset and going to the opera. And
gorgeous music, yes. Yeah. It's an extraordinary experience. So make the most of it and enjoy The Marriage of Figaro.
Thanks again, Desiree, for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And I would also like to thank our wonderful sound engineer, Marilyn LeBlanc, here at KSFR, and Peter Hull, who put together all the musical selections.
Yes, he spent many hours putting together all these cuts, but hopefully they've whetted your appetite for the operas.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654, and the local number is 505-986-5900.